Or to the council? Captain Edwards?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Norman Edwards, a commercial fisherman and member of the Fisheries Consultancy Committee from the town of East Hampton in New York. I'd like to make this statement. The Neshaminy Fisheries Service has proposed an interim rule that could have a devastating economic impact on the fishing communities of Long Island, New York, by closing down a huge area of ground fishing because suddenly we realize that the stock of southern New England winter flounder is only at 9% of sustainable biomass, and there's only a 1% chance that the stock can be rebuilt by 2014. Why did this happen all of a sudden? What are we going to do about it? Who is going to suffer by shutting down the flounder fishery, and is that alone enough to save a fish stock that is now in dire straits? Yes, one may say that the inshore stock of southern New England winter flounder will suffer the most, but along with this unique ground fish stock, the fishing communities, which have lived off the harvest of multiple species of fish in this proposed closed area for over 200 years, will now suffer. It's not to say that we don't have to sacrifice, but will that sacrifice be justified if the rebuilding of the inshore stock of southern New England winter flounder is put solely on the fishermen, when fisheries managers, scientists, and conservationists working together in other capacities to bring a successful recovery of the inshore flounder stock would be a much more diligent approach and have a greater chance of success? What about National Standard 8? Doesn't that part of the Magnuson Act require that fisheries management take into account the economic impact of closing a fishery on the communities that border this huge area chosen for the closure model? That being said, we need to do something different, and we need to act now, because fisheries management has operated under a policy that has failed to rejuvenate several stocks of ground fish since 1998, when the Sustainable Fisheries Act was passed and many ground fish stocks were at their lowest level. Unfortunately, southern New England winter flounder is now at its lowest state, when other ground fish stocks are on the path to rebuilding or have been rebuilt. One must ask why. In the past two decades, the inshore flounder stock has attempted to breed in the bays and harbors of eastern Long Island annually, with essential marine habitat depleted and an ever-increasing number of predators which thrive in the shallow waters during the winter when flounders come inshore, and in the summer when young flounders are in the shallow nursery areas. On top of this, add little curtailment of fishing effort. Yet I submit that not much pressure was being placed upon the stock because of the winter and early spring catch continued to decline. The result of these forces caused a steady decline in the number of returning winter flounder spawning stock to the nursery areas, and I suspect that it was accelerated in the most recent past due to the persistence of predation. Now, with the state of the stock at 9% of its sustainable biomass, National Marine Fisheries Service proposes to shut down the area from Cape Cod to the New York Bight to all ground fishing, which will greatly impact the fishing communities that depend upon the harvest of the ground fish in the winter and spring, and multiple species that the remainder of the year. I submit to you that the problem has been much more than harvesting this species in those areas. For those inshore nursery areas are essential to the survival of this unique stock and have supported a robust inshore winter fishery from World War II until the late 1980s, or roughly 40 years. When the brown tide infiltrated the inshore bays and harbors several years in the late 80s, the state of the eelgrass beds dwindled. Local bay scallop populations, along with the winter flounder stock, started their downward spiral. In conjunction with this reduction in adequate habitat for our now dwindling stock of winter flounder to breed and feed, we have allowed the state of predation on this stock to get totally out of hand, with our emphasis to rebuild this stock put upon the backs of the fishermen once again. Unfortunately, this emphasis was preceded by the rebuilding of the predatory stock of striped bass, which were declared fully recovered in 1996 and have been on top of the food chain of these breeding waters for the past 10 years. These fish continually feed on herring and winter flounders during the winter, for there's no other fin fish in these waters during the winter. Consequently, over the same period, we have observed the biomass of river herring, which come into the local estuaries to spawn, go into a significant decline. And research in the Connecticut River has shown that the overpopulation of striped bass in these waters has caused their decline. Along the herring with herring that move into the inshore waters of eastern Long Island are the increased number of harbor seals that annually takes up residence for the winter months. With those mammals consuming 40 pounds of swimming fish each day, it's a wonder how any significant number of breeding winter flounder can make it back to the nursery areas to regenerate the stock. Those that are successful and produce juveniles in the inshore bays and harbors leave for deeper water in the summer, but leave behind their young to mature while they try to hide from the ever-growing flocks of cormorants that effectively gobble up as many as 40 a day. Therefore, what do we really need to do to bring the inshore stock of southern New England winter flounder back to its sustainable level and have any chance of rebuilding an inshore winter fishery? I recommend that it is high time for fisheries managers join forces with scientists, fishermen, conservationists, and address the root cause of winter flounder's demise and seriously embrace the means of jump-starting the stock's recovery through stock enhancement. 10 years of research by the University of New Hampshire has shown that the winter flounder is a viable stock to be rebuilt by stock enhancement efforts. I submit to you that if we are really serious about bringing this stock back, that we act now by not just cutting the harvest of these species and again put the whole burden upon the fishermen, but we need to also support and fund efforts that enhance the stock, control out of proportion predation in these breeding areas, and rebuild the inshore nursery areas to give southern New England winter flounder half a chance. Our leadership needs to think outside the box and have the vision of community-based fisheries management that embraces science, conservation, and sound fisheries principles. If we are going to successfully rebuild this inshore stock, as well as revitalize an industry that could again one day be a robust winter fishery, the town of East Hampton in New York has the facilities and the will to act proactively in taking this approach to help this inshore stock of winter flounder rebuild. But it needs support from state, regional, and federal fisheries management, as well as the scientific community, and funding sources to produce a serious effort of stock enhancement. The town has already started its habitat restoration and demonstrated success with the first eelgrass sanctuary being established on Long Island last summer. An effort to improve the winter flounder's chance of survival in the wild has been tried in our local hatchery by using brood stock to raise fingerlings past the stage of metamorphosis and then adapting them to the natural environment before release to greatly increase their survival rate. This community involvement, which includes the principles of science, conservation, and sound fisheries management, can act as a model for other breeding areas of winter flounders, including the large nursery area in Narragansett Bay. The time is now to support and to act based upon sound principles and policies if we are to save the inshore stocks and rebuild a fishery. For it would be most wise for fisheries management to be proactive and support these efforts, which put something back rather than just taking more away from the fishermen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Captain Edwards.
One push. My name is Daniel Nordstrom. I'm a lobster bait dealer who for the past 20 years participated in the Little Skate bait fishery. I'm also an advisor to the Skate Committee, and at this time I'd like to reserve the right to speak during or after the SSC report, because this will be the first time I've heard from them since November, and I'd like to hear what their position is before I make comment.
That's fine, Dan. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your attention. My name is Phil Bolger. I'm an independent boat designer with 57 years of experience. Designed a wide variety of craft, including some commercial fishermen. And I'm here to speak because out of concern for the health of fishing communities in general, and Gloucester in particular. I'm a Gloucester native. We have noticed a great deal of research into the tools of the fishermen. Wide variety of tools have been studied and so forth. Good, thank you. But what we have not found is any research on the subject of vessel economics, which the boat would seem to be the principal tool of the fishermen. And there has been no research that we're aware of on the subject of vessel design. We have put in about 6 years of intense study on this lately out of concern for the subject, and it feels very lonely on it because we can find no one else working on it. We've talked to scientists, various university academics, fishermen. They pay more attention than anyone else so far, and we have signatures approving of our proposals from about 40 fishermen, plus various shore interests. And I have here the results of our study, which I'll turn over to you shortly. But at the moment, I wish to simply speak of the fact that there has been no research on it, except by us, on this very significant tool. And the result is that the fleet is operating with vessels and boats essentially designed in the 1980s. There has been no advance and little study put into vessel design since that time. These vessels were designed in the days of $1 a gallon fuel and a relatively plentiful stock before the diminishing of the stock was fully recognized. And it is certainly time that something was done about this, because the use of this fleet has led to very bad proposals for how to handle it. As, for example, there is a proposal on the table to buy out and presumably destroy one half of the fleet. The Romans, when they wanted to punish a unit, took every tenth man, but it has now been proposed to take every other man and presumably retrain in some fashion the displaced fishermen. And this is quite unnecessary. They have been ignoring the possibilities for developing more advanced fishermen that can operate economically, sustainably, on the present reduced catch. And when the catch rebounds, they will be in a great position to be exceedingly profitable. The approach is based on using this form of technology and simply reducing the number of vessels catching. There's been steady reduction in days at sea, and there are various regulations on the books which have a very pernicious effect on the design of the vessels, in which it seems to us this council is in a position to do something about. What the council can do to rectify this situation is first to examine the regulations for things which lead to uneconomical boats. There are several very prominent things in the present regulations, but it should be gone through line by line to pick out the things which are resource neutral, but nevertheless have a pernicious effect on the economics of the fisheries. A conference should be called. I have a list here of things that this council should address. It should look into line by line through the regulations things that tend to high carbon operation, and by regulation and by habitual practices of the fleet. There are numerous things that can be done in that direction. This conference should define the least carbon solutions based on least carbon designs of fishing vessels. They should regulate weight, not length, of the vessel. Regulating by length has led to very uneconomical designs, wide, deep, and heavy for their length, which is not a formula for economical operation. There has been no incentive, except from certain fishermen who have approached us about it, to work on hybrid power. They speak of sail, not out of romantics, but out of a suggestion that they can reduce their fuel consumption. The fleet should be ready. I'm aware that the price of oil has gone down and the price of diesel fuel has been reduced, but it will come back. There is no chance that the price of fuel will not rise. I doubt that anyone will give me much argument on that point. But fleet should be ready to operate economically and sustainably on $5 a gallon fuel, and from there into orbit, no doubt. Picture a fleet with the same number of operations, the same number of boats, the same number of fishermen, but operating on hugely reduced first and operating costs to allow sharing of a limited catch with resource recovery. This could operate. We have produced a good deal of material. We've been working on this for 6 years now, and in this folder, which I will presently turn over, or my partner will, for the councils to examine at leisure. But it outlines in things we have published and other work we have done, including preliminary designs for various economical fishermen, which should be examined in connection with the vessel economic study in general. And we picture a very efficient, handsome, and completely sustainable fleet, which can be built relatively quickly with local labor and in every way produce a solution to this problem of reduced catch in uneconomical vessels. My partner will distribute some material on this, and we will turn over this folder for the edification of this council. Thank you for your attention, gentlemen and ladies. It is appreciated.
Thank you. Tom Osmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Osmers from representing the six towns on the Vineyard and the tribe of the Aquinnah-Wampanoag. So I just thought I'd say a few words. We are a little bit late in revising our sector proposal. I've been on the phone with Tom Neese, and I want to say thanks. I've been offered help from both Jackie O'Dell and Eric Brazier. There's certain things of our sector proposal that we'll probably have to realign with the other sector proposals. I'm not sure exactly what is going to happen in our little fishing community there on the Vineyard. I've been a fisherman all my life. I've seen quite a lot of change in the industry. I feel like we've been part of some kind of history here now and change into an output-based or a quota-based system. Some ways a big step towards some may conceive as being the privatization of the public trust. I'm hoping that there'll still be a place in the future in fishing for our community. The issue, of course, is the allocation and future access. Many of our permits are A-day permits, but without history on account of the problem that has afflicted many communities along the coast, down Maine, Rhode Island, New Hampshire. I mean, I believe there's quite a few. All the states have been affected by this. In our original sector proposal, we did ask for a quota allocation. I'm not sure if such a thing really exists as a community development quota. I've been told that it does. In other ways, I've been told that we should have to go out and beg money in some ways to somehow gain access again to what was our heritage and our history. As far as the membership of tribal members in our sector, I'm told also that that may not, in fact, be possible, but they may be better off on their own. I'm hoping that coming out of this process that we may, in fact, see an end to some of the darker parts of the recent history of fishing, which is we go out there and we end up throwing away almost more fish than we catch. The area where we live, of course, on the vineyards, is 25 miles or so south of New Bedford. We have a different stock composition than areas down east further, and many times we run up against a trip limit. And on a recent trip, the first tow, we had twice the amount of yellowtails that we were allowed for the day. We had to fire them overboard, and the only thing we could keep was this stock that's in trouble now, was the blackbacks, and we caught dogfish. Well, we couldn't keep them. The scup, the quota was full, so we were throwing them away, and then fluke all day long, every tow, throwing those away. I'd certainly be glad to see something better than that, whether this new plan eventually will lead to some more positive change. I feel like if they credit us with the history of all the fish they made us throw away, we'd be in business and sailing pretty high right up there along with everybody else. But we are working to reform our plans and see where it goes from there. I just want to say thanks to the council and hoping that in your minds you will at least consider the possibility of somehow enabling these smaller communities that have in through no fault of their own or because perhaps even, I know there's no credit given for conservation-minded behavior as such, and that everything seems to be so money-related, even though the permits initially were given out at no cost. They, of course, represent maybe a golden parachute for retirement for some of these aging captains of our fleet. I'm hopeful that there'll be a better future than the present now offers us. And I just want to say thanks again to the council and to everyone here again. I'm happy to be part of the process. We've been coming to the meetings. I've had the Lyme disease of late, which has kind of sapped some of my optimism. I mean, I've had Lyme depression, like Lyme chronic fatigue, and I was on the verge of Lyme Tourette's, which might be a new one. But I'm hopeful. I see and sense from this council not only a great mental and intellectual acuity, but also I have a feeling that there is within the heart of each council member a sense of justice. Justice. And that sense of justice must some way feel for the plight of the small fishing communities such as we have there on the vineyard in Menempshire and in Vineyard Haven, in the town of Egertown, and on the island of Cuttyhunk and little communities down Maine, et cetera. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Aaron?
Good morning. Thank you. I'm Aaron Doherty with the Penobscot East Resource Center in Stonington, Maine. The project that I'm working on is the Down East Initiative, and I've talked to many, if not all of you, about that before. And I just wanted to take a minute today to mention what we're doing with the Down East Initiative relative to groundfish and what our plans are for that in the future. The Down East Initiative is a project to rebuild a sustainable groundfish fishery in eastern Maine. We have a rich groundfish history in that area. as does the rest of the New England coast, but that doesn't exist anymore. We used to have at least a dozen ground fish boats in each town along the coast, and it was a varied fishery between lobster and ground fish and scallops and shrimp and so forth. That opportunity has disappeared in large part because the areas where these fishermen traditionally fish, these were small boats, 35 to 45 feet, day boat fishermen. As the area got depleted, those opportunities disappeared. And now we're looking at a region that is ecologically depleted. The coastal shelf doesn't support ground fish in any abundance anymore. And hopefully that's starting to come back. There are a couple signs here and there, I guess just anecdotal evidence at this point, but we would like to conduct some science to see if ground fish is actually rebuilding and if the area could support a small-scale hook fishery. We're left with 24 permits in eastern Maine between the Penobscot Bay and in the Canadian line, and the vast majority of those permits don't have any more A-days on them. These are limited access ground fish permits that I'm talking about. A couple A-days left, but most of them don't have A-days, and most of them stopped fishing before the qualifying years for sectors. So not only do they not have A-days, they also don't have catch history that would entitle them to any significant ace for sectors. So what we're doing, per the suggestion of several of you on the council, and we've been committed to buying our way back into the fishery, we are now working on plans to develop a permit bank, similar to what the Cape Cod hook fishermen have done. And it's obviously a very expensive road to take, but that is one of the options that we're pursuing. And so we hope to get a few fishermen on the water either this summer or next year. There are a number of people who want to go, and hopefully we can work with them to do that. And to do what we're calling a sentinel fishery, to like I said before, to see if that area could support a small-scale hook fishery and do it in a sustainable way. In the long term, success for ground fishing in this region, if there is going to be a future for ground fishing in eastern Maine, it's going to depend on a couple different things. One of them is area management. And the reason that we need area management in that region is to protect the critical habitat that, through the history of ground fishing, really hasn't had the protection. And I'm not putting the blame on any particular area. I mean, I know that eastern Maine, obviously, did a wonderful job in overfishing, and gill netting certainly had its impact on that area. But we need to protect critical habitat, including spawning and juvenile areas, now and into the future. And I think that area management is the best way to do that. And another piece of it, in addition to permit banking, I think, is community development quota. What Tom was just talking about, permit banking is certainly a piece of the puzzle, but I think that community development quota is an opportunity to protect fishing in areas in these traditional fishing communities where you've seen a loss of access because of a depletion, long-term persistent depletion of ground fish. And many of these areas, not just eastern Maine, but they're facing the very real scenario down the road of as the fish return, there are no fishing rights in that area. Now, we can certainly raise the money, but I think that the obligation also falls on the council to recognize these traditional fishing areas and to devote some quota to those down the road. And I think how you do that and what amount you do that, that's certainly up for debate, but I think that's something that should be strongly considered. So thank you for your time.
Thanks, Aaron. Anyone else? Yes, ma'am.
My name is Susanna Altenburger. Phil is my husband. We've been working together for 15 years. Just want to follow up on what he was sharing with you. He doesn't know how to blow his own horn in public. He doesn't understand the microphone necessarily with his own bad hearing. But he has been speaking in public since 1948 in writing. First article in the March issue of 1948, Rudder magazine. Many ideas in a Maine Coast Fisherman, when it was still called that. Six books with McGraw-Hill, 679 consecutive designs, mostly discussing economics, including safety. We will not be part of any boat building or design project that will not be inherently unsinkable by structure and design. You can kill anything, you can burn it, you can sink it by overloading. But any fishing vessel we'd be talking about would be an advance in safety and not just an advance in economy of it. We will not be associated with more names on the Fisherman's Memorial Monument in Gloucester. We just lost two friends of our cause. And apart from the legalities that you shouldn't kill your own clients, we have been able to gather the support by now of 40 local fishermen across all tribes, all convictions, all feuds, all fisheries, dragomen, lobstermen, gillnetters, longliners, sword fishermen, any type of hull, any kind of power, any kind of mindset. We've also been able to gather support from the Conservation Law Foundation, a big two-page letter from Peter Shelley. Those folks took 6 months of belly aching in-house whether they would want to commit like this in public. Two smaller organizations have shared their support with us. And what's most important at this point in time, our city leader, Mayor Carolyn Kirk, first woman mayor in Gloucester, has come forward to explicitly support. She sees the future of a working port, of which Gloucester is one of the larger ones in New England, only if the fleet is structurally sustainable alongside a sustainable resource. She understands that you cannot discard the working knowledge, and you cannot discard the port infrastructures, and you cannot ride roughshod over the resource either. This whole is an integrated system, hence fails in my concern to see vessel economics, carbon-heavy regulation, and generally the impulse for some of the guys, at least, that my engine is bigger than yours, for a lot of these things to be reconsidered. We live in the age of Obama, whether some folks voted for him or not. We're living in an age of a fairly green Congress. We're living in an age of a new head of NIMS, of NOAA. We're living in an age in which discarding the idea, dismissing the notion of low-carbon regulation, fishing vessel design, construction, and operation, and the overall mindset of the industry, where this is not regular part of any meeting, where this is not part of a dedicated conference, where this is not part of the basic mindset of a growing, progressive sense of literacy in meta-sustainable beyond the resource. I think this is hard to explain to civilians out there who are not part of this well-choreographed organizational structure that you have in the industry. They cannot believe that on land you can get a tax credit for a Prius, for a hybrid. But at sea, fishermen, they can't even come forward and ask how about it. When grown fishermen, in quotation marks, folks who have all the battle scars of 20, 30 years at sea, and in council meetings like this, some of them have been through bankruptcy and back, when they mention the word sail, S-A-I-L, not for the romance, but because they are cold, hard-nosed, looking at black rather than red numbers on an annual balance sheet, I think this is a time to examine why are these people talking like that, and why are some of the guys, Dan Edwards, for instance, he's far away from here, he's in British Columbia, but he read our National Fisherman article. He flew us out for 6 days, financed by EcoTrust of Canada, but moderated, and I was driven around by a longliner. Last year, he pumped 1.4 million pounds of dogfish, rockfish, and other sustainably permitted species. He's a serious man. His son is in the operation. His daughters work in fisheries management in Canada. When he mentions that he would like to retire with the greenest damn boat in the province, I think this council might be intrigued or might be interested to examine how can we spread that spirit. When Matty Thompson from Monhegan Island discusses the same mindset, he says, take my boat, give me yours. I want to beat it to death. I want to see what's wrong with it. I want to see what's right with it. I want to take it into harm's way and I want to come back. I want to be part of this. When folks in Gloucester say the same thing, I think it's important to bear this in mind because the rest of the world out here who are getting tax credits to weatherize the house, to do something about your long-distance commute, none of us can understand why in this industry this subject matter is significantly underplayed, if at all, present in any agenda. We looked at the record of the Northeast Consortium, for instance. We looked at the record of cooperative research. None of this subject matter is anywhere part of it. And why we understand, we've been told? Somebody else is doing that. Nobody else is doing this. I've attended IBEX conferences in Florida about international boat builder exposition. I've been to ICs, gear specialists. I've talked to workboat folks. Nobody's addressing this. It's not happening. It's a void. It's an orphan. The buck gets kicked along down the line. Nobody's to blame, except here and now, one more time, we try to raise awareness on this. We're not good at speaking in public. We're not good at politicking. We usually survive, like many fishermen in a private sector out there. We live from commission to commission. They've been doing well. And we're booked for another year at least. And Phil will never retire. But this cause in our home port, now my home port too, despite my accent, we will not stop provoking, proposing, suggesting, and showing by example. We hope that we can get some resonance out of the council and would like you to consider having a dedicated meeting, a dedicated conference on what the options are. If we were in it for the big money, we would have given up after hour 200 or 300. We're nearing 1,600 hours of pro bono time. For a small business, that's near suicidal. So my husband at 81, he's going to be 82 this year, he's not in it for the glory. He's had his glory. 6 books, hundreds of articles. He doesn't need any more. So do not misunderstand. We're hustling for precious contracts in this recession. We are set. We are okay. We're not flush, but we are fine. That's not the point. So please take it seriously. Appreciate your patience. And I think you better stop. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're done with the public comment period. Move on to a review of experimental fishery permit applications, tab 14.